You know, sometimes you get the bear and sometimes the bear gets you. But it's time now for the infectious disease program, and we've got Sharon and your guest on the line. Sharon, can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can.
All righty, it's all yours.
Well, we're very pleased today to have Dr. Vincent Racanello. He is a Higgins Professor in the Department of Microbiology at Columbia University's College of Physicians and Surgeons. He is one of four virologists who has recently authored Principles of Animal Virology, a well-respected textbook used by many teaching virology to undergraduate, medical, and postgraduate students. As an esteemed member of the scientific community, Dr. Racanello has been bestowed several awards, including the Irma T. Herschel and NIH Merit. He has been a Harvey Society lecturer at Rockefeller University, the Hillman lecturer at the University of Chicago, and the university lecturer at Columbia University. Dr. Racanello has served on the editorial boards of scientific journals, including the Journal of Virology, and is a community editor for the open access journal PLOS Pathogens. He graduated from Cornell University in 1974 and completed his PhD in the laboratory of Dr. Peter Palese in 1980, studying genetic reassortment of influenza viruses. Welcome, Dr. Racanello.
Thanks, Sharon. Glad to be here.
Well, what's going on with this H1N1 virus right now?
Seems not right now. Things have quieted down quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
At least here in the U.S., if you look at the CDC numbers, they're way down from a peak just about last month.
Mm-hmm.
Which is not to say that it's gone forever. And I'm afraid that a lot of people may decide not to get immunized as a result of this. But it's still there. There is still activity. It's being isolated, just less frequently.
There's a lot of talk about several subjects. We should probably just hit them all. The first one would be this whole thing of low reactor. How effective is the vaccine that's out there, the California vaccine? Is this potentially why people aren't getting it? Do they think it's not effective? There's been some reports that it's mutated. What's your take on all that?
Well, I haven't seen any evidence that the vaccine is not effective. There are no changes in the viral proteins that I have seen which are affecting the reactivity of the antibodies that are induced by the vaccine. In any case, it would be very unusual that the virus would already change within 6 months to escape the vaccine. It's not impossible. In the viral world, nothing is impossible. But I haven't seen any reason to believe so, and we've had a lot of discussion online about this, and the data just aren't there. So at the moment, the vaccine is great. It protects you. It may not protect you next year, but we're talking about it right now.
Mm-hmm.
So there's as far as I can see, there's no vaccine failure.
Well, you know, we see things like China reported 8 mutations, and is it because a lot of things have to line up altogether in order for the vaccine to not be a good match anymore? It's not just one particular position in the code. It would have to be maybe a series of things, no?
Well, there are specific places on the viral proteins. So let's talk about the hemagglutinin and the HA protein. This is very important in terms of protection. Antibodies against the hemagglutinin are important for protecting you against getting infected. We know within that protein there are very specific areas that the antibodies that we make are directed against. Those are called the antigenic sites for the protein. And when they change, then the antibodies can no longer bind to the protein and they can no longer block infection by the virus. So there are very precisely defined places on the viral protein that interact with antibodies. So you can have one or a few amino acid changes within those antigenic sites. That could be enough to prevent the antibodies from binding. Now, I haven't seen this yet in the H1N1 of 2009. So if China reports that there are mutations, it doesn't mean anything unless we know exactly where they are.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to confirm the effect of these mutations by taking the virus with the change and seeing how it combines with antibodies. So there are lab tests we can do. They're called HI or hemagglutination inhibition assays to really study how the antibody is combining with virus. And until that's done, it's really premature to conclude anything from a mutation in the virus.
Well, and also, I think the press uses these words, and not all the reporters know exactly the meaning of what they're saying and the possible
sure.
ramifications of what they're saying.
Well, for example, could I just say mutation in itself? Everyone uses this word really loosely. Mutation is really a change in nucleic acid. So if you say a virus mutates, what you mean is that the nucleic acid is changing, whether it be a DNA virus or an RNA virus. And what really is making the difference here is a change in the protein, which is caused by a change in the nucleic acid. You may view that as a technicality, but the change in the protein is not a mutation. That's a protein change and amino acid change, the mutations in the nucleic acid. So many people throw around the concept of mutation without really being precise about what they're saying. So I've read many times, oh, the virus hasn't mutated yet. Well, that simply isn't true, because all viruses mutate, and they do so continually. So it's hard, because we have a lot of access to information now that we didn't before. So when I was learning viruses, you had to look in textbooks, and you had to go into dusty libraries. And now you can just go on the Internet and get tons of information, but you have to be careful, because you have to make sure it's coming from places where they know what they're talking about.
Sure, and it's hard for people who aren't scientifically trained to
sure.
know the difference, especially at the at reporter level.
Right.
And then, you know, I tend to call it change or drift, or, you know, it's hard for me to know, because what I know about virology would fit on the head of a pin. You know, I'm learning all the time, but it you know, it is hard to try and keep track of. And the bottom line everyone wants to know is the vaccine still effective? And, you know, and then we bring up the question of antivirals. Is Tamiflu effective still? We're seeing reports from public health officials in some countries and that they have found not a case but a strain. So is that really a new strain of H1N1 that is Tamiflu resistant or Oseltamivir resistant? Or are they really referring to a case? It's hard for me
right.
to always know what they mean.
Yeah, I understand that when you see a report in the news, it's always difficult to interpret what's going on. I personally like to look at the data when they come from a scientific source.
Mm-hmm.
So reading it in a news report is often incorrect. So a good example was there was a recent report from Egypt that someone had been co-infected with an H5N1 and an H1N1 influenza virus, and it turned out to be wrong. So if you had waited for the scientific reporting of that information, you have a much better chance of getting the right information. So so you asked, is Tamiflu still effective? It is still effective against the vast majority of the circulating H1N1. There are isolated cases of resistance, which we fully expect. You know, the old seasonal H1N1 strains eventually were all resistant to Tamiflu. And as long as this virus circulates and we use the drug, it will eventually become completely resistant. But at the moment, the drug still works. Now, if you happen to be the very rare person who gets infected with a drug-resistant strain, it's not going to work for you. But right now, it's still a good option. But it does point out the problem that we don't have enough antivirals against influenza. We really do need more. And probably having a good vaccine has slowed antiviral development. You know, for HIV, we don't have a vaccine. We have over 20 antivirals. So it's the opposite. But I assume that in the coming years, we'll get more. And maybe this pandemic and the resistance to Tamiflu that emerged before it will stimulate that.
Well, it's I think they're reporting 50 cases around the world at this point of isolated cases / maybe it's part of maybe it's a strain. It's hard to, you know, read all these reports and really know. But at this point, it's your feeling that it's still effective.
It's effective. Look at that number, 50 or so out of how many millions of people who have been infected. It's a vanishingly small number of resistant viruses. Mm-hmm. And whether they're, some may be related, others may be independent. So in other words, is there one strain which is spreading globally? I think not, because otherwise we would see greater incidence, unless it could be that that strain, when it becomes resistant to the drug, now can't transmit very well. But the number speaks for itself, 50 out of millions and millions of people who have been infected. So right now the drug is fine, and if you have the option, you should take it, but it is better to get immunized if that's also an option.
In the latest CDC flu view, they say find a couple of viruses that showed reduced titers against the California 07. Would you expect that to go up as the virus learns to adapt?
What do you mean they found a few viruses with reduced
titers?
It says
here, quote, two viruses, 0.3% tested showed reduced titers with anti-serum produced against A, California 07-209.
Mm-hmm.
Out of, you know, the group that they tested. Would we find that, do you expect that will go up over time?
Sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, if that's what I think it is, and I can't quite tell because I'm not... Oh, I see here, two viruses tested showed reduced titers with anti-serum against California. They're not telling us how much it's reduced.
Mm-hmm.
0.3% is not very much. But yes, that should continue to rise as the virus drifts, mm-hmm. as it changes, as it continues to circulate. Yes, it will. That number will rise, and maybe next season, so next winter, next November, December, in the Northern Hemisphere, it might be significantly higher, in which case the vaccine would not work.
Mm-hmm.
So what has to happen in the winter in the Southern Hemisphere, which I think begins around April or May, that's their flu season, and we will be looking at the viruses isolated during the Southern Hemisphere's flu season and trying to decide right away whether they've sufficiently drifted to justify making a new vaccine. So I would expect that number, yes, to go up. It could go up enough, and there is a cutoff point at which they say, oh, we need a new vaccine, and then they have to pick a new strain and grow the vaccine over the summer, as they did this year.
In the same flu view under their antiviral resistance section,
sure. Yes.
They talk about the 50 cases of resistance that have been identified in the United States since April 2009, and there mm-hmm. were four identified last week. And apparently 40 of those cases have been identified since September 1st.
Mm-hmm.
So is that just a matter of they're testing more for it? Or are we seeing an acceleration there? Or is that just a statistical anomaly?
Well, it's correct. We're not testing any more than we did over the summer, I think. We've had a high surveillance activity since April for this virus, so it's not a consequence of sampling. It's a real increase. I mean, it's not a huge increase considering all the infections that have gone on in the U.S., but it's as you would expect. Once there is one or a few drug-resistant viruses circulating in people, they will spread. And they may spread for other reasons. They may have mutations or changes that allow them to spread more effectively, and those may coincidentally make them resistant to drug. But this will keep going up. If you come back to this page every week, for the next few months here, that number will rise, and it will rise continuously. And at some point, it could be that, so this H1N1 strain will eventually become a seasonal influenza virus strain. It won't have pandemic properties anymore. It'll cause flu every year. And it may be in a year or two, it's completely resistant to Tamiflu.
Mm-hmm.
That I wouldn't be surprised to see.
Were you surprised at how fast seasonal H1N1 became resistant?
Actually, it took a while. It took more than a year.
Mm-hmm.
I remember tracking it from the point where the drugs were licensed. And I teach a course in virology every year, And I remember in the beginning there was no resistance, and then perhaps the next year of the course there was a bit more, and it was only after a while, quite a while, over a year or two, that it was completely resistant. So I was surprised that it took so long, in fact. And of course we have very little resistance to the inhalable neuraminidase inhibitor, which is nice, but I'm not sure. See, in this CDC page that you're referring to, all tested viruses retain their sensitivity to the zanamivir, the other inhibitor, which is inhaled. Mm-hmm. And that was also the case with H1N1. There was very little resistance with seasonal H1N1. Very little resistance. So I think that this will go up. This number will go up, and eventually they'll all be resistant. And we need more inhibitors that target different parts of the virus, so we're not locked into this.
Is that because a virus just looks for holes in the defense, doesn't it?
Well, the virus changes so much. So this is one thing that perhaps most people don't appreciate. The generation time for a virus like this one is about 8 hours. In 8 hours in a cell, a whole new crop of viruses are produced. And on top of that, hundreds and hundreds of millions of new viruses are produced. So these viruses evolve incredibly rapidly. And as they're replicating, they make a lot of mistakes. And these viruses make about one mistake every time they copy their RNA. So just by chance, in all the error viruses that are made, there's going to be one that is resistant to any drug that you have that would inhibit it. And I like to use this number. Right now, today, there are, on this planet, 10 to the 16th HIV genomes. So that's a big number, 10 exponential 16. That means, with the number of mistakes that virus makes as it multiplies, there are viruses resistant to every antiviral against HIV that we have or will ever develop in the next 100 years. They're already here today, just by chance. And that's just because these viruses make so many errors as they multiply. So that's the way the viruses have evolved. They've evolved to be error-prone, and it really helps them adapt to new environments, new host species, and now the humans come along with their antivirals, no problem. The viruses can get around it.
So what would be the best way to outwit them?
Well, the best thing is to have treat with three or more antivirals at the same time, as we do with HIV. And for HIV, we have over 20 drugs. We use combinations of three. It takes a lot longer to get resistance to all three drugs. Eventually, it does emerge. It takes years. And then you just change the combination of three drugs. And that way, someone could live their whole life with AIDS. So if we had 20 drugs against flu, we could do that, and resistance would not be an issue. So that's the solution.
Very interesting. That would work for the same thing as for colds and other viruses too, right?
Yeah. Any antiviral where resistance is a problem, and they all are, that would benefit. You could solve the issue by having a big arsenal, as we say.
I see that you do some work with zinc. Is that another way around, possibly around the whole thing?
So zinc is a metal, as you know, and it's used as a salt like zinc chloride. And it was found many years ago in the 1970s to inhibit rhinoviruses, which cause another respiratory infection, the common cold. And this is basically an antiviral, yeah. It's not used very much. It's certainly not used the way Tamiflu is used. Tamiflu, of course, you take as a pill. It goes into your circulation and then protects you at your respiratory surfaces. Zinc is, at the moment, zinc is a toxic metal, so you can't take very much of it. And at the moment, it's only used in cough drops and lozenges. But it does inhibit virus replication. And if we had something that looked like zinc, it wasn't toxic, it could be that it would be useful in a similar way. But if we just used zinc, we would get resistance, the same way we get resistance to Tamiflu.
And that's because the virus design, the basic design, is really designed to get around almost anything.
In its lifestyle, yes, it can get around pretty much anything. It can change hosts, can escape drugs that inhibit it. It can escape antibodies or the immune response of any kind. They're incredibly flexible because of this error-prone multiplication lifestyle, yeah.
Hmm. Well, that gets us back to vaccines then, doesn't it?
It does, and that's why with flu we need a new vaccine every year. Unfortunately, most viruses don't vary to the extent that flu does. So flu is almost unique. Flu and HIV and just a few other viruses have the ability to change so much that they can escape the protection conferred by vaccines. Because if you look at some of the other big viral diseases, polio, measles, mumps, rubella, with all of those, we've used one vaccine for years and years, decades, and there's never any change that makes the vaccine ineffective, or as you said before, causes vaccine failure. It doesn't happen with polio or measles or mumps or rubella. But flu is unique, and HIV is another one. The virus can change enough that the vaccine isn't effective. And that's pretty amazing, because most viruses don't do that.
It is really astonishing. What are your comments about how this thing is sort of intraspecies, you know, cats, dogs, humans?
Yeah, flu is everywhere.
Yeah.
It affects almost every species, and that's also unusual. Most viruses are somewhat restricted in the hosts that they infect. Polio, for example, only infects people as far as we know. The same with measles. Some viruses have a broader host range, like pox viruses can infect a variety of species, but flu is huge. It's amazing the number of animals, both domestic and wild animals, all kinds of species, and that contributes to the problem, right? Because you can't ever get rid of it. With polio, we think we might eradicate the virus one day, but we will never eradicate influenza. It's just in too many animals.
Right, and so can you explain the mechanism in pigs? Pigs are always referred to as the mixing vessel. So how is that?
Well, when we talk about viruses infecting cells, the first thing that has to happen is the viruses are bouncing around everywhere, even wherever you're sitting. There are probably some viruses floating around you, and they encounter cells randomly. And in order to get into the cell, which they must do in order to replicate, they have to attach to something on the surface. We call that a receptor. And these receptors are different for different viruses. They're normally things on the cell that have a role for the cell, but viruses have evolved to use them to grab onto and pull themselves into the cell. So influenza viruses use very specific receptors. They use actually a sugar called sialic acid, and it's usually a sugar that's attached to a protein called the glycoprotein. And the way that sialic acid is typically attached to a second sugar, galactose, and it can be attached in chemically different ways. And so we say basically there are two kinds of receptors for influenza viruses, and pigs have both of them. So humans have more or less one kind, and birds have a second kind, but pigs have both. So pigs can be infected with avian viruses, or they can be infected with human viruses, because they have receptors in their respiratory tracts for both. And so the idea has arisen over the years, and there was some experimental evidence that pigs could be infected with viruses from different species, and then those viruses could mix their genetic information and produce new viruses. And here today with 2009 H1N1 virus, it's proven that this can actually happen. Well, I shouldn't say it's proven. We think it happened in a pig, the mixing of all these viruses to make this strain, but it's not been proven technically. So that's why they're called mixing vessels.
So many people were surprised by this thing. We were looking for maybe a pandemic virus to come out of Indonesia or Egypt or some sort of H5N1 derivative. And this thing, obviously, we found it, I don't know that it started there, in Mexico, at the doorstep of the U.S., and an H1N1 form. You know, how did that happen, and how did we totally miss this, and how long do you think this thing was really around, probably infecting humans?
Yeah, well, we were all, many virologists, many epidemiologists were focusing on H5N1 because, you know, this is a recently emerged high virulence influenza virus from birds, emerged in the 90s, and it's, whenever it infects people, it's very lethal. So it made people think immediately of the 1918 pandemic, which had very high lethality in people. So everyone thought, if this ever goes into people, this is going to be bad. So this actually, in my view, really got the whole area of pandemic preparedness moving, that and the bioterror initiative. It was H5N1 and 9/11. And we totally ignored any other kind of influenza viruses. And there were virologists out there who said, hey, you shouldn't focus on H5N1. You know, it's been infecting people in China for decades, and it's never become a pandemic strain. What we should look at are other strains that have infected humans a long time ago, which may come back, because this emergence of pandemic viruses often involves recycling of parts of human viruses. So I think a large part of the public health establishment was focused on this H5N1, totally forgetting about other human viruses. So how this happened, who knows? I don't think it's been circulating for a long time in humans, this particular virus. We're not quite sure where. We know that it started in Mexico, but it could have originated in a number of other places. We don't have a lot of good surveillance of pigs all over the world for influenza viruses to know that. We might find out in the next few years or so. I think everyone now is looking very intensely in pigs, and they're making lots of isolations of influenza viruses. But I'm not surprised, because, you know, the pig industry has been growing hugely over the years, and people need to take care of the pigs, so there's lots of contact between pig workers and pig farms. And we've known for a number of years that the viruses can go back and forth between pigs and people. In fact, you know, the 1918 strain of influenza is thought to have entered humans and pigs at about the same time from a bird source, perhaps. And before that, there really wasn't any influenza in pigs. And so that's when we think swine flu began. And it's been evolving since then. So, you know, in retrospect, everything becomes clear. So we shouldn't be surprised that this originated in pigs. But I think that's the scenario. It's been incubating in pigs. Pigs can be infected with multiple viruses from humans, from birds who fly overhead and excrete in the pigs' farms, and the viruses can infect the pigs. So it's really the perfect mixing vessel.
Mm-hmm. And then there's just some last change that enables it to be really quite widespread. And notice,
absolutely, yes.
And that's
go ahead.
And that's when we picked it up, of course.
Yeah, so that's really important. So, you know, over the years, there have been isolated incidents of influenza viruses infecting people, but just a few here and there. They never transmitted extensively. This virus had all the changes needed to transmit really effectively in people. And it's a chance thing. It's just because in the pigs, the virus was mutating. And at one point, the right combination of genes and mutations emerged, and boom, that was enough to infect someone. And it had to be at the time when there was a person nearby that the virus could be transmitted to. You can imagine that if the right person wasn't there, it would never have been transmitted. And maybe that in part explains why it takes so many years for a pandemic strain to emerge.
Well, I think, sure, that would be, it makes sense. It's such a mystery, though, don't you think, all of this natural? There's so much we don't know.
Yeah, there is, and it's only one virus. You know, this is influenza. There are many, many other viruses out there that we don't understand, and we need a lot more virologists in the world. So my call to everyone is who's at an early stage of their training, do virology. There's a lot to do.
Well, it's like a big mystery for me. As a layperson, it's just like a mystery.
Yeah.
Trying to come up with what's going on and what's happening, and then you get the piece of the puzzle over here, and then you try to fit it in over there. And
sure. Well, that's part of the reason why I started blogging and podcasting and write a textbook, because I've taught students over the years, but my ability to teach a lot of people is limited in a classroom. I could teach, at 100 people a year or so, but with the internet I can reach thousands now. So I can try and teach people. And I always say, look, don't just learn about flu. Learn about all viruses. Learn the principles. And that way you'll understand all viral infections better. Because now with this flu year, everyone is focusing on this, and that's what's driving their interest. And that's fine, but if you learn the basics, if you learn how all viruses work, you'll really understand better. So a lot of your frustration comes from not having a really broad background in virology. And that's what I'm trying to provide.
Well, I think you're doing a great job. You have several things you're doing. You're doing something called BioCrowd.
So about a year ago, we started a site called BioCrowd, the idea being to make sort of a Facebook for scientists. And we have a number of members who go there and exchange information, look for jobs, interact, and we're trying to make it more of a media-oriented site now. Turns out that scientists aren't terribly social, so having a specific site for them to interact isn't a great idea, but I think if we give them other things to do, like upload videos, PowerPoints, PDFs, and so forth, that it'll be an interesting resource.
And then you have your blog, Virology Blog.
So I have Virology Blog, right, and I've been doing that since 2004. And in the past year, of course, I've become much more involved in that. And it's really wonderful, all the people that that go there and ask questions and argue sometimes. But I think it's a good forum for learning all viruses. We do a lot of flu, obviously, but if you want to learn about all viruses and immunity, it's a good place to start.
And then you have TWIVs of This Week in Virology, you do, which is another
right.
radio.
Yeah, so that's a podcast. We do every Friday. We have a conversation, myself and my colleague here, another professor, Dick Despommiers, and we usually involve a number of other people, sometimes virologists, and we have a conversation and we record it. So it's not an interview. We sit down and have a chat. We like to tell people, just think you're sitting in our living room and we're sitting around on chairs and talking about viruses. And so it's recorded and uploaded. It's on iTunes. It's on twiv.tv. And again, we get a lot of interactivity. People are always sending in questions and comments and corrections. And I find that's a great forum for teaching and learning.
Well, I like the format myself. It is like a chat. And
And
your humor comes out. You know, it's casual. Mm-hmm. It's like sitting in... it sounds like you're all sitting in the living room.
Yeah, I think it's important to be casual and relaxed. I think that promotes teaching. If you're too formal, it intimidates and people don't learn as well. So if you like to listen and learn, and there are lots of, situations in the world where you can't read. I have a huge commute, so that's how I started listening to podcasts. And so if you're doing that, if you're exercising or doing any other activity where you can't read, a podcast is great. So I do both blogging, if people prefer to read, and podcasting, which is not for everybody, but apparently there are a lot of people out there that love it.
Are you still doing This Week in Parasitism?
Parasitism we just started at the end of last year, and that's a monthly, even though it's called This Week, it's a monthly podcast. And then Dick Despommiers, who is a professor here, is a parasitologist, so that's his expertise. And, viruses are parasites, so that really fits in with TWIV as well. And there in that podcast, I ask all the silly questions, because I don't know anything about parasites like Trichinella, Toxoplasma, and Dick explains it, so we're having a lot of fun with that.
And... is that it? I think that's
I think that's it. And that better be it. Because I do have a job that I'm supposed to be doing. And if I did anything more. Someone wrote to me the other day, and he asked me if I wanted to do a This Week in Cholesterol. And, you know, I could do many This Week in Bacteria, yeah. But I have to limit myself because I have a research lab. I have teaching obligations as well.
You started your lab in, what, 81 or 2,
well, no? I started my lab here in 1982, correct. Right.
So that keeps you busy?
It keeps me busy. Yes, and I actually do some experiments as well in the laboratory. I have students in the lab who do most of the work, but I love doing virology experiments. I just like going in there and handling viruses. It makes me understand it far better than you could if you're just reading about it.
Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with the ferret experiments and the transmissibility of H1N1 and H5N1 also?
I'm sorry, which
experiment? There's been some ferret studies. Are you familiar with those?
Yes, mm-hmm. yes.
What do you think of those?
Well, you know, when we study transmission, it's always a problem because with flu, it's hard to do it in people. With rhinovirus, which is a lot milder of an respiratory infection than flu, you can actually use human volunteers and infect them, and you can study transmission. But it's very hard to do with flu. So you have to use animals. And animals are just models. That's why we call them animal models. And the ferret seems to be a good model for understanding influenza, but you have to always be careful because it's not people. And you may get results that sound great, but unless you can somehow validate them in people, it's always an unknown. You're never sure if what you find in a mouse or in a ferret duplicates what's going on in people. So, for example, no one has ever made a decision about vaccines based on what you find in a mouse or a ferret. You simply can't do that. You have to do clinical trials in people and make a decision based on that. Well, that being said, I love animal models. I think they're terrific, and we have used them over the years as well. We've learned a lot about transmission of influenza from ferrets, and also now there's a guinea pig model, which seems to be a good model for transmission. We've learned a lot about the genes of the virus that are involved in virulence. So they have their place, absolutely.
Does the virulence place, let's say for H1N1, would it be different per flu? Something that might have caused a certain placement of an acid in one strain of flu might be a different in a different strain of flu, no?
Sure, okay. Sure. I mean, it could go both ways. There can be changes that have a similar effect in different strains, or it could be strain-specific, yes.
So just because something caused virulence in 1918 H1N1 doesn't mean it would cause virulence today in this H1N1, no?
Not necessarily. You could experimentally look at that. Of course, the only way you can do it is to look at an animal, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you had an amino acid change that you think is important for the virulence of the 1918 strain, you could put it into a contemporary strain, but you'd have to look at that in animals. Can't put it in people. It's not ethical, right? And then even if you found that it increased the virulence, you would still need data from people to assert that it played a role in virulence. Now, because this virus is circulating so extensively right now, and because we have the ability to sequence a great deal, we can make correlations. We could see the sequences of the strains that are circulating, we can try and compare them with disease. But human studies are always difficult because humans are really different. You know, you can breed mice so that they're genetically very similar, and you can make ferrets very similar. But people are really different. They're genetically diverse. They live in different places with different climates, different diets. There's so many variables. You really have to be very careful when making conclusions about viral virulence in people.
I saw early on in the summer one of the autopsies from a poor victim who had died of H1N1, and it was pretty clear that for some individuals it hits their bronchial upper respiratory and and lungs, lower respiratory, pretty fast.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you brought up cholesterol. Are you familiar with any of the studies on statins and treatment of the host response?
I know that there's been some suggestion that statins might be valuable. I'm not terribly familiar with that literature, though.
Mm-hmm. That's not really virology, is it?
It depends. But, you know, this virus, the H1N1, we talked earlier about using two different receptors. So there are avian-type receptors and human-type. And this virus can use both pretty effectively. So it turns out that the avian-like receptors are present in the very lowest parts of the human respiratory tract. Okay, so this virus, in theory, could go into the lower tract and grow while there. And that's very different from the seasonal H1N1 that circulated previously. So maybe some of those lower respiratory cases with a lot of lung involvement is a reflection of this. But again, here's the caveat. It can't simply be that this virus has an ability to bind to receptors in the lung, because the same virus infects many, many people and it doesn't cause severe lung disease in them. So that's telling me that there are host issues that are also controlling the virulence of the virus. And that's, of course, not surprising. Host differences are always involved in pathogenesis, but the people who are dying of lower respiratory tract influenza must have some difference from the people right next to them who are not dying and who are infected with the exact same strain of virus.
Sure. The other thing that has come up is, of course, reinfection.
Right.
Many people not only think they've had it once, but they've had it twice. Now, can you explain how that's possible?
So first of all, you have to be careful, because you may not be getting flu both times unless your laboratory confirmed. Who knows? It could all be anecdotal information. And just being here at a medical center, I know that a lot of respiratory infections that mimic influenza are not influenza. They can be caused by other viruses. So you may think you had flu twice, but in fact you may have had flu once, and rhinovirus or adenovirus or any other virus the second time, or maybe even both times. So that's one issue that you have to be careful about, unless you're laboratory confirmed double flu. Okay, but let's say you're infected twice and both times it is flu. Well, if you are infected very soon after the first incident, within, say, a month, your immune response hasn't matured yet. And so it's easy to get reinfected. It takes at least 3 to 4 weeks to get a good immune response, which would be protective. And with a lot of virus circulating as it is now in a pandemic year, it's very easy to be reinfected. And especially if you're in a hospital, you can easily be reinfected in a short period of time. So basically the explanation there is that your immune response hasn't had time to mature, and that's why you're reinfected. Now, other people aren't able to mount a good immune response. They have deficiencies which are often not recognized, and so they can be infected multiple times because they never do make a protective immune response. But these are very rare cases, I think. The bona fide influenza reinfections are very rare.
Some people say that the, first of all, of course, they presume that they had it once or twice.
Right.
And not are absolutely lab-confirmed H1N1. Mm-hmm. And others say that their tests came back negative, and those tests are faulty.
Right.
So in these cases, really, people should still consider getting the vaccine, because, you know, we really don't know.
I think there's so much uncertainty in these cases, yes, that you should take the vaccine. The rapid antigen tests are very imprecise. They can be wrong half the time. And then most people don't get the more sensitive assays, which look for viral nucleic acid. So there's so much uncertainty, I think that you should err on the side of getting the vaccine for sure. There's really no downside to doing that. if you've had flu both times, well, the vaccine will boost your immunity, so it will get better. And if you haven't had influenza, then you'll have immunity.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to take a second, and as you know, Flu Trackers, we're a team, and we have, in fact, last month we were viewed by individuals from 186 countries. That's
fabulous.
That's just December. We're very, very, very lucky that we have so many international participants, and I'd like to take a second to thank them all. Literally, we're online 24 hours a day, and these participants allow us to stay online and contribute to the site. And, of course, you know, we're nonprofit and free to the world, too. So I always take a moment to thank them all. ARR 309, Alaska Denise, Apple Blossom, Alert, Amish Country, Anne, John Barry, Blue, Bonesit, Michael Costin, Kelvin 11, Chuck, Kartsky, Common Ground, Dark Horse, David Fedson, Greg Dworkin, Dutchie, Emily, Disimama, Evelyn, Estacion, Farmer, Frenchie Girl, German Doctor, GSGS, Ganderspell, Hawkeye, Hogweed, Hornblower, Ionor Hopper, Jeremy, Jim O, Jay Jackson, KBD, Kent Nickel, Kiwi Bird, Laidback Al, Legadillo, Lily, El Monte, Makoto, Missouri Watcher, Michelle Marier, Mathematician, Mama Bird, Melly, Mingus, Mixon, Mod Tech, Muscad, JC Roll, Nancy, Susan Chu, Ruth B. Me, Prep Deb, Roror, Nico, Steve Osteen, Nickel, Snickle Fritz, Pathfinder, Revere, Ready Mom, Shiloh, Sharp, Science Teacher, Shannon, Teresa 42, Sally Furness, Shiloh, Grattan Woodson, Scott McPherson, Thornton, Trayfish, Tonka, Sukermis, Tual. That's quite a few. That's not even everyone. For anyone I missed, I'm sorry. But, you know, it's quite an undertaking. We're publishing in five languages every day, and we also publish intermittently in other languages. But, you know, we're online every day in English, Spanish, French, German, Italian, and we have Norwegian, quite a bit of Norwegian coming on the site now. So, you know, it's quite an undertaking every day for all of our participants to help us the way we do. And it's really helpful to have you on the, with us because, like I said, there's so many things that come across the transom, like, you know, mutations over here. And then you're thinking,
sure.
Well, what does that mean in the real world? Is that really a mutation? Is that a drift? And then somebody will say, oh, on the internet, oh, this means the vaccine isn't effective anymore. And it's like, well, wait a minute. You know, it should still be relatively effective unless you've had some huge quantum jump that I don't even understand how that would happen. And so we're monitoring this all the time, and we try to just get to the truth of things.
Well, I think it's great that all those individuals that you named are interested and want to learn what's going on. And I encourage everyone to come by our blog, and if you have questions, ask. And I recognize some of those names of people who have visited Virology blog, so that's great.
Sure, we have some scientists that post. They're more comfortable using a moniker than they are their real name.
Sure.
For some, and I understand. You know, the internet can be a wild place, and you know, they're publishing papers and they're doing other things, and so. We have, I'd say, several that post anonymously. But if you read them enough, you know, you're going to know.
Sure, of course. You get personalities, yeah.
Yeah, you're going to know, you know, that this has got to be this guy who wrote who participated in this paper anyway, because they'll focus on that paper,
yeah.
Or they know a lot about it or something. But we're just thrilled that they do participate. And, you know, I didn't know about your, before today, your science group. So that's an important thing, the bio crowd.
Yeah, I know that some people also prefer a forum-type interaction, which is what you have at your site. And I have plans to do a forum at Virology blog as well. Several people have asked to do that, so that should be launching soon, and we'll see how people deal with that. Commenting on individual posts tends to get lost with time, so I understand that a forum might be a little better.
You know, I don't know, blog, and I think there's pros and cons to each format.
Yeah.
You know, the blog, I think, emphasizes what you think is important faster.
Yeah, right.
I think the forum is a great archive.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's just depending on the personal style, you know, of what you prefer and what you think will work. And, you know, the more people out there doing this, the better off we are. And we're almost finished, but I wanted to ask the one last question that everybody always wants to know. And I don't know if you've covered it in your blog, but, of course, H5N1 hasn't gone anywhere, like you said. We have a lot fewer cases that were reported this year all around the world. This time last year, we were looking at, I think, 8 new cases in China coming a couple in December, and then they continued, you know, 1 or 2 every week for the first few weeks in 2009. Indonesia just announced they had 20 cases this year, but frankly, those are 20 cases that we'd already pretty much counted through local public health official announcements and medical director announcements for maybe the first quarter of 2009. So I suspect they've got more there. And of course, everyone wants to know now, will H5N1 and H1N1 reassort?
Well, you know, prediction is very difficult. And I don't think there's anyone that could predict. In theory, yes, they could. There's no reason why they would not reassort. Whether they would reassort and make a virus that transmits as well as the 2009 H1N1, who knows? There have been H1N1 swine viruses and H5N1 circulating for many years, and they've had opportunities to reassort. The thing that's confounding is that as our population grows and our food animals grow in number, we get more and more interaction among them and with, in this case, wild birds that carry a lot of strains of influenza. So any experience that we've had in the past may not apply to the future any longer. So we could say, well, you know, H5N1s have been circulating in China for decades. There's a high percentage of seropositivity in the population, yet we've never seen the emergence of a virus that can transmit effectively. But maybe with increased contact with pigs and birds and greater population, that could change. So I don't know. It's theoretically possible, and it's theoretically possible that a virulent virus that transmits well could come out of it. No one knows the answer. I know a lot of people think they can predict it, but you can't. And all I can say is that as far as viruses go, it could happen. So we have to be vigilant. I think we have a good system for looking. Unfortunately, we're not quite sure what to look for yet, and that's why we have to keep sampling from wild birds and from pigs and people these viruses, and maybe we can get an idea. So I'm sorry I can't give you a number in how many years that's going to happen and what it's going to do, but if anyone tried to do that, I think it would be incorrect.
Well, that's generally, that's, you know, everyone says they just don't know.
Right.
But it's a possibility, just because maybe almost anything is a possibility, right?
With viruses, almost anything is possible, absolutely. You're always surprised. They come from places you never think, and there will be more. As we look, we will find more. And so that is the one constant with viruses, is that you never know what's going to happen next.
That's what keeps it so potent, I think.
It does.
It keeps us from really being able to ever mount a good defense. So where you have a chance, like with polio, to maybe eradicate that completely, we probably will never have that chance with influenza.
Never. No, that's one thing. It will never happen. Is unless all life is gone from the globe, it won't be eradicated.
All life is gone from the globe. I was looking at your latest blog, and again, you want to tell everyone the name of your blog?
Yeah, they were.
It's a virology blog at virology.ws.
Okay. And you have, as your latest one, 10 virology stories of 2009.
A guy named David
Right.
Hahn.
And out of all of these, what was your favorite
one?
What was your favorite thing to follow, really?
There was a.
Okay, so we did 10 stories of 2009 and. You know, on our latest TWIV, and my favorite one is the viruses in the Antarctic lake. So a group went down to Antarctica. It turns out there are freshwater lakes down there. They're surrounded by ice, and they sampled through the ice cover the viruses that live in the lakes. You have to remember, Antarctica is dark most of the winter, and there's there are very few kinds of life that exist in the lake. Yet, there is a huge diversity of viruses, and they found at least 25 brand new viruses that had never been seen before. So that's amazing to me. And this is probably just, I hate to say this, it's just the tip of the iceberg.
Wow, so is that because viruses really do well in the cold, don't they?
They can. They can do well in almost any extreme environment. They do well in salt, high salt lakes. They do well at the vents at the bottom of the ocean that are hot. And they can live in and adapt to extreme environments, absolutely.
Wow. So have they characterized these viruses at all?
Well, all they did was take some pictures of them and they sequenced them. But they didn't try to grow any of them. Or they don't even know what they're infecting in the lake. And some of them are viruses that we know infect birds and mammals, and there are none of those in the lake. So what they're infecting is a mystery. So there's so much new stuff here. That's why I love this story. So that if you go to Virology Blog, you'll see a link to the original story. It's just fascinating.
David, are you trying to talk to us? He usually is soft, and he's trying to tells me it's the end now. And then I don't hear him very well. But anyway, well, thank you so much for being with us. And thank you so much for just giving us so much information. And I really feel like I learned a lot.
I'm glad. That's the whole thing. That's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to teach. So if you learned, we accomplished something. And thanks so much for asking me on.
Well, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, Sharon, we appreciate it, and we'll be back with the infectious disease program next Monday. We appreciate you tuning in. Stay tuned now for Your Eyes with Dr. Andrew Schatz. We'll be back after a few announcements from our sponsors, so stay tuned.